what was Toyota's experience like in Formula One back in the day? Like you obviously mentioned earlier, biggest spending team in Formula One, never win. They have the, I think, the same operating budget as Ferrari or Mercedes in the current era, but they never,
I mean, like, Toyota was such a giant back in the day. Like, just to give some bit of context, was Toyota entered, they were granted Formula One entry in 2000 to enter in 2001. They paid the entry fee for 2001, but they said, no thanks. We will waive the deposit there and we will just spend the whole year testing. Yeah, back in the day, that's when they were.
Welcome to RacePod.
Welcome back to another episode. My name is Nathan.
And I'm Jonathan.
Together, we are the co-hosts of RacePod, where we talk about all things Formula One.
RacePod is the extension of Race Recap, a LinkedIn newsletter created by two F1 fans where we discuss the world of Formula One. RacePod serves as an extension to that content pillar, where we will speak about various off-track events from the F1 grid, while also looking at other motorsports around the wider community.
Alright, we're back with another episode. This is on the at the start of the United States Grand Prix, actually. And actually, we're recording this in a very special, unique timing, because typically throughout a season, you only have one break, right? And that is the summer break. But right now, we actually got two breaks, and actually, we just experienced 4 weeks without Formula One. So yeah, John, like, how do you actually, like, keep yourself occupied with, you know, no racing, you know, in at least in the world of Formula One?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting time for the wider sporting world. It's a bit similar to when we had the spring break for the time being, where we had about 3 or 4 weeks as well. What I do would be get acquainted with the other sports that I follow, still suffering through Manchester United doing whatever they do, and sometimes just listening to what playoff baseball is happening. Formula E is due to come back soon, and we're just going to see what happens throughout the season, and we'll see how it goes.
Nice. Yeah, it's always good to keep your mind preoccupied with other forms of racing as well. Obviously, the world of racing is so big, it's more than just Formula One. And that actually neatly ties to a point, actually, to a figure that we're going to talk about. And let's just get straight into the episode, right? Obviously, during the Singapore Grand Prix, it was a very pivotal weekend for one of the drivers, Daniel Ricciardo. And actually, a few days after the Singaporean Grand Prix, it was announced that Daniel Ricciardo, the Honey Badger, good high-performance athlete, is going to depart V-Cup, and Liam Lawson will continue to race for V-Cup to the end of 2024, effective immediately, actually, right from this race weekend. So the Honey Badger actually returned to the sport after a sour stint with McLaren, which saw the Australian leave the papaya team at the end of the 2022 season. But thanks to a test in an old Red Bull machinery, the Milton Keynes team opted to replace Nick DeVries with Daniel midway through the 2023 season. So Daniel's goal of coming back to V-Cup has always been one thing, right? He wants to get back into the Red Bull family. And there was plenty of rumors this season that he could actually replace Sergio Perez when the Mexican endured a run of poor performances, especially in certain parts of the 2023 season and this year in 2024 as well. And during the 2024 Singapore Grand Prix, there were intense speculations as to whether Daniel will continue to be in the cockpit for the United States Grand Prix. So as we all know, a few days later, V-Cup announced that Liam Lawson, which is their reserve driver, will take Daniel's place for the rest of this season. Which brings us to our first talking point, right? So in your opinion, John, like, how could have V-Cup and Red Bull actually handled the situation a lot better, right? I mean, from the surface, it was just a big PR disaster. So yeah.
I guess one of the things they could have done better was either decided not to give Daniel the 2024 season, either just give Lawson the full season, or if they wanted to give Daniel a bit more time, maybe basically a full year, they would probably could have replaced Daniel around the summer break, and then to say, okay, you're not performing, we gave you a shot, but it didn't turn out, and then now we're just going to give Lawson. I'm sorry that happened. Kind of similar what I thought William should have done with Sargeant when they replaced him with Filipino. But in the end, the fact that when it came to the Singapore Grand Prix, everybody kind of knew that it was Ricciardo's last race. Even Ricciardo was like, I had a good time. It was a good ride. It was pretty much an open secret at that point. And then, well, there was a whole fastest lap thing. It was like Ricciardo's final goodbye. Even the fans knew. That's why they voted him driver of the day. So it was not the best handle, but we've seen a lot worse from RB. So I guess it could have been worse.
Yeah, I think just to add additional context to this question, right? Apparently, according to a lot of reports, I mean, obviously, there was a lot of suggestion with regards to the timeline, but there were there was actually reports to go on. I think it was later revealed that as well that Lawson actually knew that he was going to replace Ricciardo, I think, that week when the Singapore Grand Prix happened. And then after that, there was also reports to suggest that Helmut Marko and Daniel himself also kind of knew, but it was just never announced. So that's why throughout the race weekend, you just see Daniel just giving a lot of hints, right? Like, oh, you know, I'm not sure whether I'll be in the next race. And especially that final post-race interview, which was like a super emotional one.
Like Ricciardo was on the verge of tears at the point.
Yeah, like after the race, he was just sitting in his car, just rubbing. Like, they just know it's, if you know that that you're still going to be in the cockpit the very next race, why would you sit in the car for like just 10 minutes or whatever, just pondering? Like, it's, that was like a huge date giveaway, but nothing was ever announced. It was this weird, awkward thingy where like he can't really say anything, but at the same time, he knew that he was on the chopping block already. But I mean, let's bring our attention to like Liam Lawson, right? So obviously, great standing performance last year when Ricciardo injured his hand. And according to a podcast that Christian Horner did with F1 as well, Horner himself revealed that they needed answers, right? Because right now, the Red Bull camp is pretty unstable, right? I mean, we'll get to that.
Have they really been stable?
Yeah, that's true as well. But like, apparently they are preparing for a possibility if Max Verstappen were to leave the team, right? So what does Liam actually need to do for the next couple of races to show that he actually deserves that second Red Bull seat?
I would think, first of all, he needs to match Tsunoda regularly first. And then match Tsunoda, if possible, beat Tsunoda. Which, I mean, fair enough, especially Yuki is the incumbent in the seat. He's had, I think, 2021, 2022, 2023, but three and a half, three and three quarter years in the team at this point. So at that point, you should match Yuki, if not beat Yuki, which, fair enough. And I think the worst position to be in at this point is probably Yuki Tsunoda, because there's no win for Yuki. Because Yuki comprehensively beat Ricciardo, but there's no possibility of promotion there. So if Yuki beats Lawson, that's kind of expected. If Yuki loses to Lawson, Yuki is out of F1.
That's true as well.
Yeah. So like, I think that's why I got this from the race, and that's like fair, very fair point. Lawson has things to prove, but Yuki, there's no winning either way. I mean, if you're Tsunoda, probably time to find another seat. I mean, Audi is still looking, so why not, right?
Yeah, but I mean, at this point in the season, I mean, the market is closing really fast.
Yeah, there's only one empty seat left in Audi.
whoever is so desperate to take that seat, sure.
I mean, it's probably better than the Alpine seat, but
I think the Alpines are all filled. I mean, with Doohan and Gasly for next season, so even if there was a seat there, Yeah. I mean, I totally agree with you. I think Yuki has a lot more to lose than Lawson as well. But then again, like, if Lawson somehow magically pulls off like a brilliant stint in the next couple of races, I don't know, man. That second Red Bull seat is just like, it does weird things to people. So I'm not exactly sure, like, even if he gets the promotion, how well will he fare against Max? And if Max leaves as well, is Lawson the next Verstappen? I'm not entirely sure. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit hard because I don't think they have like a top Max Verstappen replacement. Yep. Like, Max Verstappen was the Vettel replacement everybody was waiting.
Yep.
But then Perez is probably been too old. Yuki is good, but he's probably like a Perez level.
Yep.
Then we don't know what Lawson is going to be like yet.
But I mean, considering the way the circus is going, like, you never know, right? All of a sudden, like, for next year, Marco has given hints that lineup might not stay as well. So yeah, Ricciardo is out for the moment, but you never know with F1, right? But I mean, looking back at his illustrious career, like, what were some of your favorite moments from the Honey Badger? So obviously, I came into the sport when like he was in Renault, if I'm not mistaken. Like, yeah, 2018 was the year he left Red Bull. Wait, yeah, 2018. Yeah, so I was in that era. So I never really grew up with the iconic Honey Badger, you know, when he first came in to Red Bull, to being promoted, and like, you know, those very, very cool, iconic moments during the hybrid era as well. So yeah, what were some of your favorite moments, John?
I would say I'll probably give one from 2014. Besides his debut win in Canada, which was really good, I would think a more notable win would be his charge from the back in a wet-soaked race in the 2014 Hungarian Grand Prix. After he pitted, he passed both Lewis Hamilton driving his Mercedes and Fernando Alonso leading the race in his godforsaken Ferrari, which is like, bless him, he tried. And he managed to win that for his second ever race win. That was incredible. Another one would be in 2016 Malaysia, actually. I think after the whole Hamilton engine DNF, Ricardo as the team leader, he led home a Red Bull 1-2 ahead of this young guy, Max Verstappen, at that time.
Yeah.
That 2017 Baku, really good race as well. It was a really chaotic one, fought from the back and drove through the field. If you see clips on Facebook or YouTube, there's always the triple overtake into turn one. That was the race.
Oh yeah, yep.
That was the race. Then 2018 China, also quite a good race. That's where all the late braking heroics came in and got him his first win. And everybody knew what happened in 2018 Monaco with the iconic dive into the pool.
Oh yeah.
And the one in the turbo. So the Honey Badger has had some really good moments, but I think following the turbo, the shift to the ground effect era, his last great, really great moment was probably that McLaren 1-2 in Monza. That was probably the last great Daniel Ricciardo performance. After that, it just hasn't been the same. But he's had a good career. Now maybe he can give NASCAR or IndyCar a shot.
Yeah, I mean, like, one of his favorite quotes, one of my favorite quotes from him from that particular reason, his last win was with McLaren, right? It was a quote like, "I never left." You know, to those who thought that I left, I never left. So yeah, I mean, you never know, right? I'm sure America is a huge fan of Daniel Ricciardo. So yeah, maybe NASCAR or I don't know, man. Like, yeah, I mean, just want to wish him like all the best. And if this is really the end for him, he has had a good career, so he can look back, you know, be really proud of that. And yeah,
I'll just put it here first, because I think it'll be interesting if Ricciardo goes for sports cars and he's Australian. He hates supercars. There is like really big thing, so it should be interesting if he goes there. But yeah, can move on. I think going on to Red Bull, Red Bull's current head of strategy, Will Courtenay, will join title rival McLaren as their new sporting director. This news came in late September when McLaren announced that Red Bull's chief of race strategy would be joining them as their sporting director and reporting to their incumbent racing director, Randeep Singh. This is another part of McLaren's ongoing restructure, which began after Andrea Stella assumed the role of team principal in December 2022. As for the person in question, Courtenay has spent 14 years with Red Bull Racing, which would date him back to around the Vettel era when they were winning consecutive drivers and constructors titles. Red Bull Racing is now the third member of Red Bull senior management to leave the team in the past couple of months after Chief Technical Officer Adrian Newey's move to Aston Martin and Jonathan Wheatley's incoming new role as Audi's first team principal in F1. Red Bull's current stance would be that Courtenay will serve out the remainder of his contract until mid-2026 before being allowed to leave. But as you know, in things in Formula One, this could be due to change, especially with gardening leave and negotiations between McLaren and Red Bull. So, Nathan, do you think as a Papaya fan that is this a good move, or will this be something like how the David Sanchez hired, what happened a few months ago?
Well, I mean, that's another big figure from Red Bull leaving, right? I mean, obviously, he was the chief of race strategy as well. That's a good point on the David Sanchez thingy, because you never know, right? Obviously, they brought in a lot of huge technical figures from various teams as well, including Red Bull as well. I think Rob Marshall was from Red Bull. So yeah, I mean, I as a Papaya fan, I'm stoked to see whether that will actually help with their strategy. I think something they really needed to fix this season to have a much more stable championship battle. But yeah,
they probably needed to stop adopting Ferrari strategies.
Exactly. So yeah. I think obviously it's incredibly exciting to see what he can do, especially I think with Randeep. Randeep is quite an iconic figure within the team as well. I think he's been with the racing team for quite a fair bit. He's that figure that I always see every time when McLaren explains strategy. It's always linked to Randip. So yeah, obviously we're excited to see what he can do.
Yeah, and then following on from that, as you've mentioned, this is another Red Bull figure that's left. So what's your take on the wrath of Red Bull departures in the past couple of months? Is this something for Red Bull fans to be concerned of, or is this just Red Bull just reshuffling their deck?
Yeah, I think it really, in hindsight, it brings to my attention, at least, to Jos Verstappen's quote to say that the team is on the verge of blowing up or something to that effect. And yeah, I mean, lo and behold, after he said that, I think a couple months later, we see a lot of big, huge figure, iconic figures from Red Bull leaving. And it definitely just shows how unstable that camp is, right? You got all these big names that are leaving, and if Verstappen leaves, yeah, I don't know. I mean, Verstappen is just like that plug that's just preventing that whole ship from sinking. I mean, obviously, like in the previous episode, we discussed that there were a raft of changes that they were making internally as well to make sure they cover off all these departures. But definitely, it's a little bit eye-opening in a sense. It's like, yeah, I mean, that's a lot of big team members from a team that, like a top team like Red Bull that's leaving. Yeah, I mean, John, like, what's your take on this?
I mean, I guess it could be a sign that things are changing, especially because I think towards the end of the Mercedes dominance era, we did see that some of the senior team members were leaving or moving on. So I guess people come, people go. But I think for Red Bull's case specifically, it's not helped by some of the internal turmoil and conflict. Horner versus Marco versus Verstappen. Exciting to watch, but not great for team harmony.
Yep. And as we talk about, you know, figures leaving as well, while Red Bull is a sign of instability, I think we have another team that totally takes the cake. I think we all know, I think if you listen to the podcast long enough, like we're going to move on to Alpine, right? So yes.
Our favorite punching bag.
I mean, the cat is out of the bag, right? So yes, you got Red Bull with a bunch of huge technical figures leaving, but I think Alpine really takes the cake in the sense that they are shutting down their works engine program at the end of 2025. Yep, the cat is out of the bag. So Alpine have announced plans for a so-called hypertech transformation project that will include their Formula One power unit department ceasing operations at the end of next season. So Alpine's F1 program is currently split across two factories, the chassis focus division in Enstone, which is in the UK, and the engine focus division in Bury-Châtillon, which is in France. Under the changes, the Bury-Châtillon base, which has been designing and building engines since Alpine's parent company Renault entered the sport back in the 1970s, will not produce F1 power units post-2025, and Enstone is going to be the heart of Alpine Formula One's effort moving forward, incorporating a yet-to-be-announced engine supply arrangement for the 2026 regulation changes, and this is following a lot of talks that they are going to enter with a potential deal with Mercedes. So John, obviously you've written an analysis article very recently, actually, before this episode was out. If you have not read that piece, it's available on our newsletter as well. So yeah, you can check that out. So yeah, I think the only question is what benefits, commercial or technical, will Alpine stand to gain, if any, from willingly abandoning its work status? Yeah, that's the only question I have.
I feel like probably the only benefit it will be is, I guess it'll probably just save cost, and if Alpine is planning to...
That's what I wanted to say. It's just like, it's a cost-saving measure.
Yeah, exactly. It's a cost-saving measure, or if they want to sell up the team, it'll probably be easier to sell because it's like, oh, let's just sell up the Enstone facility.
And that also ties in neatly to another thing that also has happened recently as well, which also ties into this point. So yeah.
Yeah, and then because if you look at Renault's Formula One history, that the Viri side has been in F1 or involved in F1 a lot longer than Enstone. Enstone wasn't even Renault to begin with. They trace back to Benetton and Tolman, but the Viri side has been producing engines far longer than that when they had a separate factory Renault outfit competing in the 70s to 80s. That's where Alain Prost used to be involved in that part of Renault, not the Enstone one. So the fact that they shut it down and said, yeah, you know what? It's better for us to go as a customer. Like, it just boggles the mind. Like, in what world does that make sense? But I mean, like, besides cost, I guess.
Yeah, I guess like that's from a business perspective, it makes sense. But also, I think if Alpine is going to abandon and severe ties with Formula One come 2025, and then the French Grand Prix is no longer on the calendar as well. I mean, yeah, like that kind of boggles me. Like, why? Like, still, I get it from
if you look at it 20 years ago, I'll say more than 20 years ago, probably in the early 2000s. There was a French Grand Prix. There was a French team. They had French drivers. I think that probably Olivier Panis and a few others. French drivers. They had a French tire supplier at the time, Michelin. But I mean, that was when it was an age when they had multiple tire suppliers. So in the course of slightly more than 20 years, there's no French driver, no French tire supplier, no French Grand Prix, no French team. No French engine supplier, and which in soon enough, it's only French by the fact that Renault is a French company. Even the factory is not even in France.
It's like someone took the timeline and just like, you know, take the word French and just erase everything that's related to that. It's like, voila. But yeah, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, because how tied in France is with racing, Grand Prix is French.
No, but I mean, like what you say is true as well. I think that French, I think yeah, that's the biggest loss, to be honest, that French identity and culture within the sport. Yeah, so to trade that off for cost.
Yeah.
Sure, like you can justify that as a business decision. And yeah, I mean, we'll see.
That's for the cultural aspect. And then the other thing will be on the works thing, which is something that I wrote about in the article, was that it's mind-boggling because other teams have wanted a work status for one reason or another. McLaren tried in the Honda thing, like they were that desperate to make the world's entry thing. It didn't work, but they tried.
And then Aston Martin is going in Honda as well. Red Bull is going for it.
Yeah, and Red Bull was so desperate that they created their own power units division so that they can have that in-house work status, and that they got Ford to like support. And then Honda is trying to cultivate that with Honda going forward.
And then you even got like Andretti Cadillac. I mean, I know they're not entering Formula One, but still, like, you know, teams are fighting for that status. And Alpine is like, nah.
Yeah, it's like they're fighting for that status. There's another team that we'll discuss later in the podcast, which are possibly going to tie in right after this, actually, which they are working for it, and it's such a big thing. And then Alpine said, nah, it's okay. We do what we need. What?
It's fine, you know. It's a work status. It's just on title. It's like, no, it's such an important thing. So, yeah, but why not you take us through the next point, John? I think, like, when this news happened, I think when there was rumors of this news, it was already wow. And when it actually happened, it's like, damn. And it just makes the whole Alpine situation is like, what?
Yeah, okay, so coming back to that, and like, as I just spoke about, not exactly a works partnership, but also the tie-in with a major manufacturer. In this case, it was recently announced, actually just a couple of days ago, within this week actually, that Haas announced a tie-up with Toyota Gazoo Racing. Yeah, the Toyota Sports or Motorsports division. Haas announced a new technical partnership with Toyota Gazoo Racing, where Toyota Gazoo Racing will provide design, technical and manufacturing services to Haas. Or Haas will offer technical expertise and commercial benefits in return. Which, I mean, I can guess the commercial benefits, but I'm not sure what technical expertise there, but who knows? I don't know. But yeah, this is actually really exciting because it makes the first return to Formula One for Toyota since the shuttering of their factory team in 2009, which, if long-time Formula One fans have known, that was one of the biggest spending teams who have never won a single Grand Prix. A lot of podiums, some vibes, but no wins. In the interim 15 years, that factory where the Toyota Formula One team used to operate in Cologne now houses the Toyota Gazoo Racing, which handles all their other motorsport activities. In the interim, Toyota Gazoo Racing has won 4 World Rally Championship manufacturer titles and 5 WEC manufacturer crowns. And they're constantly duking it out for Le Mans victories. Alonso won 2 Le Mans with Toyota at a time when he was away. So with this tie-up, Haas will be given access to a lot more resources, like, as mentioned, Toyota's state-of-the-art Cologne facility, which previously housed their F1 program, and as well as an array of talented technical staff, which a lot of people, including the race, have suggested that Toyota could now send some of their engineers to work with Haas as like a secondment program or like a training and development program. And then, in addition to that, future Toyota-backed drivers could also be placed in the Haas stable as reserve or test drivers alongside assisting with the soon-to-be-built simulator program for Haas, as assisted by Toyota. This is kind of an addition to what, I can't remember the driver's name, but it was a Toyota driver that was placed as the McLaren test and simulator driver, the Japanese guy.
Yeah, I also don't know his name, but I know that there was a Japanese guy. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's something like that, but it's an extension to that.
Correct, correct.
So, yeah, it's really exciting and nice, always nice to see Toyota, such a big manufacturer in motorsport, come back. So, Nathan, how do you think that this link with Toyota would impact Haas's F1 operations?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because Haas is a very unique team. I believe the team itself, excluding their Ferrari, so yeah, they have a base like in Maranello, a small little base in Maranello, because they are effectively Ferrari's B team. They get their chassis there. They are using Ferrari engine.
Yeah, they are using Ferrari engines.
Yeah, so this doesn't, like, think of the Haas and Ferrari partnership as like addition itself, and this is just like, you know, like a sprinkle or like a sauce or something. That's a weird analogy, but okay. Yes. So it doesn't affect their technical partnership with Ferrari. So they're still using Ferrari's engine and they're still using Ferrari chassis. So this is meant to complement their partnership in a sense.
Not the chassis. The chassis is actually built by another Italian company, Dallara.
Yeah. So that's why Haas logistics is just really interesting. They got ties.
It's just things like the gearbox and some of the things that are they buy from Ferrari.
Yep. So it's basically like a Haas, Ferrari, Toyota kind of thing. Basically, it doesn't fundamentally change the partnership with Ferrari. It's just meant to basically enhance or basically supplement whatever relationship they have with Ferrari. So yeah, I guess the arrangement between Haas and Toyota, it's basically Haas opening up its doors to say that we are a Formula One team, and Toyota, it's basically they have the expertise. They are very, very successful in the World Endurance Championship as well. So it's basically sort of like a mutual learning experience for both parties as well. So yeah, I think also one of the things is like with this Toyota partnership, they're able to build their own sim as well. So that will obviously help with the development of the car. So Toyota has the expertise and the resources to build that sim that basically Haas would find it beneficial in terms of, you know, the aerodynamic data, which should aid in further developing the car. Because I don't think they have a proper simulator at the moment.
Okay, I mean, tying into that, as we know, Haas is quite an established F1 Ferrari customer and B team. They effectively became what Sauber used to be like in 10, 15 years ago. So how do you think this link with Toyota would affect Haas status as a Ferrari customer and possibly Ferrari B team?
Yeah, this ties in very neatly into the question is like, can a customer team win a world championship, right? Like, you look at McLaren right now, they are a customer team and they are topping the constructors at the moment. So, yeah, so there's always the dynamic between like the customer team and the parent team in a sense. So, I don't think this necessarily, I mean, Ferrari is Ferrari, right? They have the resources, they have the reputation, they have the standing, right? They are one of the longest Formula One team in the sport. So I don't think...
No question, they are the longest.
Oh, they are. I wasn't sure. I was just like, okay, they are the longest Formula One. Yeah, they are. They have a heritage fee for that particular reason.
Yeah.
I think they joined since the very first Formula One.
Yes.
Yep. Oh.
They were there from race two.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But I mean, like, yeah, in a sense, it doesn't necessarily... I don't see Haas putting a fight to Ferrari, basically. That's the gist of my response, so... I think that's part of the reason why Ferrari is cool with it. It's like, yeah, it's a nice nod. I think also because the team principal right now is Ayu Komatsu. So that Japanese link over there, and obviously it's kind of neat because you got also Honda entering the sport in 2026 as well. So with Toyota in the mix, like, it should be really interesting. And they never really confirmed whether this was like a one-off thing, right? It's like a multi-year partnership kind of thing.
I think it's from a multi-year partnership, but incredibly interesting news was that it's supposed to start immediately. Like, they're supposed to have Toyota Gazoo Racing stickers and like some of the branding on the Haas cars at the USGP.
Yeah, you don't see that start immediately. Usually, there's usually like a next season kind of thing, but now it's like effectively immediately from the next race. There's already branding of like TGR over there.
So I guess then one other thing is, do you think this could be a pathway for Toyota to return to F1 fully in the future?
I think to truly appreciate that question, we need to give further context on what was Toyota's experience like in Formula One back in the day. Like you obviously mentioned earlier, biggest spending team in Formula One, never win. They have the, I think, the same operating budget as Ferrari or Mercedes in the current era, but they never, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, Toyota was such a giant bank in the day. Like, just to give some bit of context, was Toyota entered, they were granted Formula 1 entry in 2000 to enter in 2001. They paid the entry fee for 2001, but they said, no thanks. We will waive the deposit there and we will just spend the whole year testing. Yeah, back in the day, you can test whenever you want, as long as you have the money. So they only entered in 2002, and then they stayed all the way until 2009, and they didn't win jack. They had podiums only in like 2005 onwards. They had podiums, they had some poles. Then they just couldn't win. It was a lot of things that, because they were very insistent on the Toyota way, whatever that's supposed to mean.
Yeah, I think, yeah, just also further enlighten us with like why the team ultimately failed. Right? From what I understand, it's just that, yeah, you mentioned the Toyota way. A lot of corporate politics, I think as a Japanese company as well, like, they wanted to do things a certain way, which wasn't the effective way to run a Formula One team.
It's a bit Japanese, but then again, you look at what Honda did. Was around at the same time, and Honda did win a race before the old Braun GP, which technically doesn't count, but they did win a race. It's like Honda and Toyota were roughly around the same, but Honda did eventually manage to win something, and well, they had Ross Braun. So a lot of it was corporate politics. A lot of it was a very insistent way on doing things. And also, there was a lot of flat-footedness because the way that Toyota operated back then was very centralized. It was all decisions had to be made from Cologne, like their motorsport space. Okay. They didn't have what McLaren has with like their ops center and all their like decentralized systems. I mean, it is a problem as well. And because like Ferrari back in the 80s and 90s, they wanted everything from Maranello. So it's a very old school racing style. So it doesn't really work, especially in Formula One. It probably works in things like WEC, but difficult. So that's kind of the thing, as well as they were spending a lot of money, but had no direction. But in the interim, they've won a lot of things elsewhere. So they're not incompetent with motorsport. They just haven't cracked F1 specifically.
Yep. So as to whether Toyota could return to F1 fully in the future, I believe that they have mentioned this partnership with Haas is probably, I say, a step in the right direction as well. I guess give them a few years to basically, you know, have a feel of it. Like, they obviously, through this partnership, they'll gain a lot of insights into what it's like to run an F1 operation in the current modern era as well.
And I mean, there's probably going to be quite a bit of ego there when they beat Honda, but we will see.
That is true as well. There's always the Honda. I believe they came into the mix is because, like, you know, they see Honda so successful, right, recently with all the domination run with Verstappen as well. So they obviously wanted to get back into the mix. So I believe that was a factor as well.
Yeah. So it's like, them having the opportunity to beat Honda is probably a factor, but
It definitely is going to be a factor. So yeah, but I believe right now they've mentioned that they are not going to enter fully into Formula One yet, but you never know. But yeah, it's still really exciting to see this Toyota back in the mix, because like, I think it's not so exciting for like new friends to join us, but for like old friends back in the day, and like this news is like, dang, it's like a ghost in the past that just pop out of nowhere.
I mean, before we move to the next bank, the one thing next really, because our post 2008, 2009, Honda left back then, came Braun, Toyota left, and now they're partner. But I'm waiting for BMW to come back.
Ooh, yeah.
The old BMW factory team has become Audi, but you know, it always is nice. So we'll see.
Yeah. Just almost there, right there in the collection. But yeah, which brings us to our next point, which is ironic because they're going to remove the point for the fastest lap in 2025, which is next season. So in the lead up to the United States Grand Prix, they actually just dropped the news that
it was just today.
Yeah. So the FIA World Motorsports Council announced today that the point for the fastest lap will be dropped in the 2025 Formula One World Championship. So the bonus point for the fastest lap made its return to the sport in 2019, having been a feature of early Formula One during the 1950s. So up to the 2024 Singapore Grand Prix, there have been 13 occasions when the fastest lap point was not awarded due to someone setting the fastest lap by finishing outside the top 10. In addition, the fastest lap point only has been awarded to the winner 36 times in 122 races since its reintroduction. While there were no official reason for the decision, there has been a wave of controversy when Daniel Ricciardo snatched the fastest lap away from the race winner Lando Norris during the recent Singaporean Grand Prix, which denied the Briton his first ever Grand Slam, which is... Basically, denied Norris his first Grand Slam, is like winning, like leading every race. What's a Grand Slam?
I think it was like a Grand Slam. So it was pole, win, fastest lap, and leading every lap.
So he did all of that except for the fastest lap.
Except the fastest point, fastest lap, yes.
Yeah, so I think the first question is, was the fastest lap point ever a good idea to begin with?
I honestly don't think it was that good of an idea because it causes all this chaos. It causes all this chaos and it just seems a bit unnecessary because, I was reading from the race earlier today as well, and I think Edstrop put a good point. What was the point for this? Especially, pardon the pun, is that what was the point for all of this? Because it kind of just makes it into like a game or like things that people can play with, like a second driver or just like a B team or just a random person from outside the top 10 just going for a glory run and then they just making the point disappear. I mean, you came into Formula 1 in 2019, Nathan. So what do you think of... I don't think you've experienced a world of Formula 1 without the fastest lap. So what does it mean to you?
Well, I mean, looking at the recent Singaporean Grand Prix, like, it definitely... Yeah, it didn't really sit well. Like, considering, like, you know, it could have been Norris's first Grand Slam and he just got taken away because Ricciardo just popped in, like, fresh set of tyres right towards the end of the race. And you've seen multiple times in multiple races where literally that happens. And yeah, like, why? Like, it's just... Like you say, it's an arbitrary mechanism. It's just an arbitrary feature to gamify Formula 1. It doesn't really make any point to begin with. Sorry. So without the fastest lap point, so are there any viable alternatives to this besides like a bonus point for pole position?
I mean, the bonus point for pole position, I think there was a bit more merit because fastest time in qualifying, like it gives you additional stat. It's disconnected from the race, so I think a bonus point for pole position, maybe, like that was my alternative because it technically is, it won't affect the outcome of the race, but it'll give you an additional one because I think some other series, I think like the junior formula, like Formula 2 has bonus point for pole position, I think. So I thought that's probably the only other alternative. If not, let's just not have any additional gaming points. We just have the full Grand Prix and the sprint, I guess, which I mean, I would want the sprint. Let's say if you're going for the top 8, you just use the old top 8 point scoring system, 10, 8, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, but that's besides the point. Yeah. So I think probably the only other alternative is probably the pole position point, but I don't think that's such a great idea either. So I think just remove those giving points. Do you have any view on it?
Yeah, I agree with you. Like, you could give bonus point for pole position, but then again, you will have like a very similar phenomenon where, like, technically, like, you know, with track evolution as well, I mean, you've seen multiple times in Q1 this season where like some random people suddenly tops like Q1 because of track evolution. So in a way, like, that's also kind of the thing that happens with fastest lap. Like, you just put on a fresh set of tires towards the end of the race and you get a fastest lap. So that's that. So I think the best solution is just get rid of it. And I mean, there's also the point with the sprint races as well, but that's besides the point. I'm so sorry about the pun.
It's so many points. And then the fact is with the sprint races, it helps, like it doesn't help. It makes calculating the championship permutations a lot more difficult.
Exactly. Like just go back to the old days where it was just a good old, like just the races, right? There was no sprint. Sprints was just a very recent addition kind of thing, just to get more racing, you know, more value for your buck. But yeah.
Is that, and like, as I said, like if you want the sprints, I think in the sprints currently it's a top 8 that score points, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, that's like, if you use it in the top 8, use the old F1 top 8 point system, 10, 8, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. They already had that back in 2003 and 2009, but hey, just besides the point, FYA, like sometimes you just don't make sense, but that's besides the point.
Yep. All right. I mean, that brings us to the end of, you know, our main points of discussion. So let's move on to the Bite Size Update. So if this is your first time listening to our episode, the Bite Size Update is basically where we talk about certain things that are not too noteworthy to discuss, but yeah, they're just good. Literally, as the title suggests, it's just a bite-sized update for you to like listen, like, oh yeah, that's a neat update. And let's move on to Formula E.
So I guess, yeah, in Formula E, it's Barbados driver Zane Maloney gets a drive in Formula E. Formula 2 race, the Formula 2 race winner is set to join the Lola Yamaha Apt team for the 2024-2025 Formula E season. He'll be replacing Nico Müller, who moved over to the Andretti Formula E outfit. The Barbados driver is currently Sauber's reserve driver and had previously been development driver for Andretti's Formula E team. With the team's new powertrains jointly developed by Lola and Yamaha, this will be a new environment for Maloney and the team as well as and to adapt to as App shifts away from their previous Mahindra power supply. So, yeah, I mean, seems interesting. Lola and Yamaha. Yamaha is very well known for their motorcycle engines, so interesting that they're going for four wheels. Lola has not been in top level motorsports since their disastrous 1997 season of one race. So interesting, but good for Maloney, and we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, I think on my end, it's just like another example where you're seeing a lot of younger F1 talents who hasn't really gotten a chance to enter Formula 1. I think the name that comes to mind was either, who's the Aston Martin reserve driver? His F2 guy also.
Filipe Dragovic. Dragovic.
Yes, Filipe Dragovic, or you got people like Thierry Porcher as well, who did really well in F2, never really got a chance. So yeah, it's... So yeah, I mean, you're just seeing like a lot of these younger F1 talents just going for other series as well.
Yeah, things like that. People like Callum Ilott as well.
Or like I think Robin. Callum Ilott. What was the other? There were a couple of like young people. I forgot what was it, also within the Ferrari Drivers Academy with Mick, with Ilott. Rob Marshall or something.
Schwartzman.
Robert Schwartzman. Yes, yeah, like dudes like him as well. So yeah, it's just another case of like, you know, sometimes the grass is green on the other side.
And sometimes you need more than 10 teams, FIA.
Take note of that, FIA. But on the other hand, also FIA related, and this is with regards to Max Verstappen actually during the Singapore Grand Prix. So in the lead up to the race, there's obviously the pre-race conference, and Verstappen sparked controversy during that session by using explicit language to describe the RB20, prompting the FIA to issue a one-day public service penalty, which is still bizarre, but I mean, when does FIA does things that are not bizarre? Anyways, the Dutchman was visibly frustrated with the decision, expressing his dissatisfaction during subsequent pre-race conference by offering very brief replies to media inquiries. Most notably, Verstappen actually did his own post-race conference before the actual FIA post-race conference and refused to answer a lot of the questions and stating that it was just better for you to ask me these questions outside of this conference. So yeah, this incident quickly caught win among a lot of people in the paddock, among fans as well, with a lot of drivers like Lando and I think Lewis. Was Lewis in that post-race conference?
I think so, but it was quite a few drivers. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but there was a lot of drivers. I think everybody in the drivers' WhatsApp group was just like complaining like, yeah, it's not fair, it's ridiculous. The Grand Prix Drivers Association chairman Alex Wurz admitted that the penalty was too severe. I think the most interesting thing was, actually there are two most interesting things. Max actually threatened that he might leave Formula 1 with all this silly punishment. And the next is actually Gunther Steiner, ex-team principal at Haas.
Everybody's favorite team principal.
If you watch F1 in the new era, especially the new Drive to Survive era, I don't think I need to explain who Gunther is, why he's so famous in that series. But if you know, you know, and you know that he's very creative with his language. And it's kind of weird that Gunther does that for, like, for context, Haas has been there since 2016. It's been about, what, 6, 7, 8 years since the inception, and Gunther has never gotten this kind of like penalty, and Max suddenly does it like one off, and like, yeah, you get a one day community service kind of thing. But yeah, what are your thoughts?
I mean, it's probably a bit of, I'm not, okay, there's probably a reason why Gunther doesn't get the same penalty as Max. It's not a valid reason, but it's possibly an explanation. It's probably because it's not a driver to driver. Gunther's a team principal.
Yeah, I was about, yeah.
Yeah, it's the same thing. Like, I think everybody has seen the clip with Toto and Christian. I think they're comparing cars or something. Then I think Christian just said to Toto, like, change your fucking car. So, and then like nothing happened out of that. So I guess that's probably the reason why Gunther didn't have the same penalty that Max did. Not saying that it's right, but that's probably one reason. But it's just very silly at the end of the day, because it's the same thing with like other sports. A lot of post-match or post-sports interviews, like a lot of them just curse. Or okay, not saying that it's good to curse all the time, but it's like, it's not said a lot. It's just like once or twice. It's like people are still suited up and pent up emotions. It's just kind of normal. And to risk losing your triple world champion, maybe 4-time world champion over this, not a good look, FIA.
Another thing to note, right? If the FIA was so insistent on regulating all this, in the words of Mohammad Sulaim, you know, show yada yada yada. If you think about it, the entire 2021 season, right, especially Abu Dhabi, right, and if you look back at it in hindsight, with the whole giving the very last lap for a show, you know, we went motor racing. I mean, that was Michael Masi and whatever. Yeah, I would argue that team principals have basically the same spotlight. You think about Toto Wolff and Horner, that whole drama and stuff like that. So to really say that because Conte was just a team principal and you can get away with it, and then like now, it's just not fair. It just doesn't make any sense to basically say that the drivers are more, you know, important than the team principal, because like they're more or less like the same. They have the same personality, same amount of reach anyway. So
no, I mean, I understand what you mean, but I would add one thing. Drivers are a lot more front-facing than team principals. So to put it into perspective of a different sport, let's say you're watching football, the players have more direct interact compared to, let's say, the manager.
Yeah.
So yes, it's quite ridiculous, but it's not apples to apples.
Yep.
It's, yeah. And I mean, it's probably not fair. It's definitely not fair. It's quite ridiculous, but team principals are not exactly the same as drivers.
Speaking about team principals and people in high positions within motor racing, I think there was another development, very, very interesting development as well. Yeah, and I'll let you take it, John.
Yeah, I mean, everybody's favorite 11 team on the supposed F1 grid, which hasn't been on the F1 grid, Andretti Global is going to have a change of CEO, with Michael Andretti stepping away from the CEO position. As he's announced that he'll be stepping down from the day-to-day responsibilities of the Andretti Global team and handing the role to Dan Tauris. So, Andretti Global's operations in Formula E, IndyCar, and IMSA remain unaffected by this change in senior leadership, but there'll be a gradual transition to matters going forward. And it seems like it's the case that Andretti Global is still going full speed ahead with their potential Formula One entry, as Andretti Global is continuing to recruit and develop for a potential 2026 F1 entry despite the FOM's refusal, as they have regularly been developing new parts, conducting continuous testing in Cologne and the wind tunnel. They've also recently opened their new facility in Silverstone. And because of running, they're not currently bound by F1's testing restrictions. You can't be restricted by the FIA if the FIA don't accept you. But yeah, so any thoughts on this? I still think F1 should admit Andretti, but yeah, money is probably the reason.
Yeah, I've watched a video from the race that kind of explains how Andretti's movement within the organization might change or affect their possibility of entering the sport as an 11 team. It basically ties, there's a lot of issues over here, which in a sense, like the Andretti's relationship with FOM, and also, yeah, it basically affects the entry, but in terms of whether him stepping down, would it basically increase their chances of entering Formula 1 as an 11 team? I have no idea. I think you're probably a lot more better and a lot more well informed of this, especially with the whole antitrust case in the US at the moment, like the anti-competitiveness kind of thing. You're a residential legal expert, so what do you think?
If you're going from a legal perspective, it shouldn't affect FOM, especially because Congress and anything, let's say if they're going to pursue legal action with the EU, like the ECJ, it probably wouldn't affect anything because the refusal is still there. If FOM says, yeah, we're going to accept you now, then you can definitely know they have a problem with Michael Andretti himself rather than the possibility. But it seems like FOM is still insistent on like, yeah, you know what, we don't need 11 team. And the FIA president has now said that, okay, if you want to get in, you buy an existing team. So like the tone has shifted for the worse for Andretti, and I'm not sure whether this would help.
Yeah, I bet it will be an interesting development to just keep an eye on. Let's just see how it goes. But at least he's not leaving the Andretti Association. I mean, he's still tied with the team. It's just, you know, shifting roles and stuff like that. So yeah, is there anything that you want to say or to conclude the episode as we approach the mark, the end of our time here?
I mean, I guess one thing would be, we're coming up to towards the end of the season. And I think this is something that I spoke to with our friend Lucas the, just over lunch today. Do you still think Max Siska can lose the Drivers' Championship?
Okay. So, if it's Lando's title to lose, Max doesn't have to do much to maintain the lead, but Lando has to deliver like a perfect run.
Wait, don't you mean that's Max's title to lose?
Yeah, I mean, basically Max doesn't have to do a lot to win the championship because he's ahead right now, and then Lando has everything to lose. And then Lando needs to deliver like a perfect run, like a Vettel level kind of run kind of thing to realistically challenge Max for the title, to be honest. So yeah, I mean, he's good, right? We've seen him deliver like really, really awesome weekends, but to do that consistently, I don't know, man. So yeah.
And I mean, McLaren is probably odds on to win the Constructors. Then the only question would be, how far up the table would Red Bull finish?
Yep. And also, there's also 2025. So if you don't do it now, I mean, there's also next year as well. So yeah, I mean, it also depends on how much resources you want to invest this year and how much you want to prepare for next year. That's always the question as we get towards the end of the season. Yep.
I mean, I saw this one joke over, but it's not relating to the whoever wins title. It's more, maybe it's Sauber's being planned to finish 10th all the time in order to maximize all the testing amount that they can get, and then they dominate 2026. Then I'm like, if that was the plan, that's like a long game, you know. If that was the plan.
Yes. Kudos. Massive respect, you know. think big. So yeah. But anyways, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening in. And if you'd like to hear more from us, don't forget to follow us on Spotify and drop us a review on what you thought about this episode. So for more updates, you can follow us on LinkedIn. Just type in the word Race Recap as well. We also have a LinkedIn newsletter. It's with the same name, Race Recap. And yeah, once again, I'm Nathan.
And I'm Jonathan.
Stay safe and I'll see you in the next episode.